Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show on the Land of Israel Network, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. It's a hot day, but inside Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, the fans are blowing, and the breeze is the waft of the smells of Jerusalem. In the distance, I hear the jackhammers building Jerusalem. I look out the window. I see the olive, the grape trees of Jerusalem, the grapevines yielding, about to yield in just another about month, their grapes. And I am in the heart of Jerusalem at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov. And you know what that means? That means that we're on Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foy. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the program.
Always a pleasure to see you.
All right, and I want to tell you, Rabbi Mike, a lot more people are telling me all the time how they listen to Spiritual Cafe, and they appreciate it's part of their life, and it's a great honor and blessing to be part of Spiritual Cafe. Amen. This show today is going to have this section here, Spiritual Cafe, and then afterwards I'm going to take us to the funeral of Irving Moskowitz. Moskowitz, and I was at the Moskowitz funeral. If you don't know, Irving Moskowitz is one of the great patrons, maybe the greatest patron, of Eastern Jerusalem and of many other things like Ariel University, Hebron, land reclamation in Jaffa and Akko, all kinds of places. By some estimation, maybe $500 million. And not only has he given $500 million, also, and this is by an estimation, nobody really knows. Also, on top of that, the incredible management that Irving Moskowitz had oversight on all these issues. Not just a patron, but a director, a CEO, a general of land reclamation and the settlement of Jewish people in the land of Israel. And then after the funeral, we're going to go to another tad sad thing, and that is Alan Weinkrantz was a PR guru for Israel, for Israel Technology. I interviewed him less than a year ago, and just a few days ago in Tel Aviv, he was killed in a tragic, really. And this is the right usage of the word tragic.
Yeah,
we're talking about he was eating in an outdoor restaurant when a driver had a heart attack, it turns out, lost control of the vehicle, plowed into eaters at the restaurant, and three people were killed.
That's including, like, divine stroke.
Right, exactly. And I'm going to have that Alan Weinkrantz interview in the third part of the show. So stay tuned for that. Fantastic radio, really. Now, as I was at the Moskowitz funeral, it was one of the best funerals. I'm one of these guys. You know, I get something from funerals. I get life energy from funerals. A good funeral of somebody who lived a life, and you hear the stories, and you're standing right next to the tomb. I got a chance just for a second to hold on to his to the bed that's being drawn to the funeral place, just for a second to carry this man to his final resting place. It gave me such an electric shock.
It was a tremendous honor to bring someone who did such work to their final rest.
Absolutely.
Here in the city that they were devoted to.
He buried maybe 10 graves away from Rav Kook.
Wow.
Okay? And overlooking the Temple Mount from the Mount of Olives. And here's the transition. One of the things that they kept talking about Irving Moskowitz is that he was absolutely dedicated to reclaiming the land of Israel. Now, I hear from all kinds of circles that I speak with all the time, people say to me, what is the importance of the land? And you have to start, and you go through the explanation, and you try to say to them all kinds of things. There are some people in this world that don't need a lot of, you know, like a lot of kind of reprogramming, reframing. They get it. They get the time when we're living in, and they get the importance, the centrality, the magic of Jerusalem and Hebron and these other places, and they don't like, and he understood it fully and engaged it right from the get-go. And I was just kind of blown away by that. Is it a surprise that he was buried on the week of Parshat Shlach, on the week where the challenge of those Jews who don't understand the centrality of the land. Yes, the land. Of course it's from the Torah. Of course we keep the Torah there. Of course we're talking about God. But yes, the value of the actual land of Israel.
It could only be a sense of justice for him to leave the world in that, because we're at such a height of the return of this argument between the spies and Moshe and Caleb and Yehoshua. And we live in an age where the power of dibur, the power of speech, is unparalleled. You know, because you, as you said, it comes from the land, and of course it comes from the Torah. The Torah is telling the story. And, you know, as much as I believe in the ultimate power of the story to some degree will always be disembodied, and that's why it can be played with, right? The idea of the land is it's the embodiment, and therefore you'll always know whether it's true or not. That's why the land vomits out the inhabitants who can't live by the story. It's why the land is the vehicle for both reward and punishment on the divine national scale, and the rains fall and the crops grow. That's not a metaphor, right? As we know here, if crops don't grow and rain doesn't fall, people starve and are thirsty, and thank God we live in a modern society, but that doesn't disappear. And so today, when everyone wants to live in such an abstracted world, and the morality is one of abstractions arguing with abstractions on equally abstract footing, the grounding in the land is what I heard from you is just a clarity. It doesn't need explanation and framing. It is a clarity which is not gained through intellection, but one which is simply lived. And therefore is symptomatic of who you are and not what you think.
You have the story is basically that the Jewish people are about to enter the land of Israel. There's 12 tribes. And before they enter the land of Israel, they come up with a rational approach saying, okay, if we're going to enter the land of Israel, let us take the rational approach. Let us acquire it through military conquest. We need to send out a forward pioneers, forward recon.
You think that was rationality?
Some argue it that way. I'm happy to hear it the other way. Spies are sent in. I'm just telling the story in short. Spies are sent in. 10 of the 12 come back with basically a report saying, yes, sure, it's a good land, but we won't be able to conquer it. We will not defeat it. We're afraid of it. You should be afraid of it. They sell a whole fear narrative. Two spies rend their clothes, tell the people, yes, we can. We will be able to be victorious. God is with us. Fear is a type of idolatry. Don't succumb to it. And the other Jews say, they follow the 10 spies and they say, let us appoint a head. And the Medrash tells us that it meant, let's have an idolatry and let us return to Egypt. In the Matrix terminology of the movie, The Matrix, plug me back into the Matrix. I want back into the fake world. I want back into the desert. And other people explain, no, they wanted a very desert existence. God is with us. He's feeding us the manna. We're like babies. We don't want to come out of the womb.
And that's the proof positive that it wasn't rational. I mean, it's true what you said, that they took a pragmatic approach of, well, listen, let's check it out first. Let's find the right path, strategy, etc. But ultimately, fear is what I see driving that decision. And fear is never rational. It may have reasonable, rational roots, but it does not embody itself in the world rationally. And that's why in the end,
It clothes itself in rationality.
It uses the tool of rationality to deceive and allow itself to succeed. But fear is never rational. Fear doesn't grab you in your forehead. It grabs you in your kishkes, in your guts, right? And that's because, yeah, the way in might be through the mind. But fear doesn't reside there. It's much deeper seated than that. And so therefore, that was the great failure of this moment in time. And I, like I say failure, and I'm always holding a question at the beginning of this parsha. You know what it is? Who blew it in that moment? Whose job was it to lead? And in a more concrete textual sense, who sent these spies in the first place?
You want to hear an interesting thing? You learn Torah in a lot of places, right?
Sure.
Sometimes you can learn Torah from different places. I once picked up a book about Israeli spycraft, written by General Ami Dror.
Sure.
Well-known figure here in Israel. And in the beginning, he actually talks about this case of the spies.
Oh, what did he say?
He says it was a tremendous mistake to send well-known people with big names and big egos and public figures. He says spycraft is by its nature a hidden thing. You don't know who these people are. They come back with information, not with opinions.
Ah.
Okay? They come back. They're not people who are well known. Hey, what did you think? And then you have to make a speech. No. These are not the deciders. The act of spycraft is the act of gathering information and intelligence. And he says, when Joshua sends spies into the land of Israel, you don't know who the names are.
Yeah, they don't even have names.
They're not named. He says that was the mistake here. You couldn't put people of that stature to be the spies. Even though it makes sense, send the Gedolim. No.
In this case, decision makers.
Yeah, send the Ketanim.
Well, it's beautiful what he's saying, what you're telling me, because that's summed up to me in this key word of the Parsha of latur. Right? It's a verb which means what?
tour. Well, spy out.
But it means to be a tourist.
Right, be a tourist.
Right? I mean, the parsha begins with Shlach lecha anashim v'yaturu et Eretz Kanan, right? Send to yourself, and we can talk about that later or not, right? These guys to check out the land, to tour it, to be tourists. You know what's the difference between a tourist and a native?
What's the difference?
A tourist comes with an outside perspective by definition. Now, you can go native, so to speak, and there's a whole model of tourism that can allow you to experience life as the people who really live here, but we all know that's bunk because you don't actually live here, you know? And you can get closer, for sure. You don't have to be, you know, in funny white hats and the cameras and all, but it means that when you go where you're going, you carry the framework of what you're going to see with you mm-hmm. when you get there. And that's exactly what the spies did. They went in, and they were afraid. Or, like General Amidor is saying, they were important people who wanted their opinions heard. Or what have you. The Zohar says that they were holy people that felt like the existence, like you mentioned, of eating the manna in the wilderness and being with God and learning Torah from Moshe was the perfect existence. And why would you ever want to change it? Whatever it was, they brought it with them. And so that's what they saw. That's all they saw. And that's beautiful because if they had just brought information, then things could have turned out differently.
Right. Not only did they they brought back some information, but they skewed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw things in a skewed manner, as the very famous phrase is that we were grasshoppers in their eyes, and so we were in ours, meaning to say that we saw ourselves as we were grasshoppers in our eyes, and so in theirs, meaning to say we saw ourselves as small, and that's the way we perceived other people saw us, or maybe indeed that's how other people saw you, the smallness. But they go against God. And they go against God, and this is a perennial question for me. Why were these folks that went against God, why do they get such a punishment? And the punishment, it's important to note, the real punishment of the sin of the golden calf was, ta-da, you get a Mishkan, you get a temple. I see that the real bad folks are going to get, you know, wiped out. But the rest of you who actually just wanted to serve God in this physical manifestation, no problem. The real kosher way to do it.
We can work with that.
We can work with that, right? Because even a slight idolatry, at least you're looking for a power above. And
listen, I mean, it's a genuine human need right. to have something to grasp in life.
Right. Right. But to reject the promises of God after all that, after being brought to the edge of the land of Israel through the splitting of the Red Sea and the receiving of the Torah at Sinai and coming to the edge and all the successes, but more than that, you did something inhuman. You rejected your parents' way.
Mm.
Your fathers and mothers gave everything up to live in this land, and they did it through poverty and through a famine. They did everything in the land of Israel to try to get there and were deathly afraid of leaving it. Now that you're on the edge, you're going to turn your back on your parents' values? That's something I can't stand, says God. You can diss me because me, I'm ineffable. I'm the big one, okay? You can't. You're going to diss me. I'll wait a generation. The next generation comes back. But you're going to diss your parents? That is you're going to spit in the face of Avram and Sarah? You're going to reject the bones of Joseph that are with you. He made you take an oath to bring him to the land. You're going to reject that too. You're going to turn around, go back to slavery. You folks are not fit. And not only did that generation get punished for a 40-year death march in the desert, the spies themselves get taken out in a way that is just
horrific.
Horrific and very rarely kind of described like that in our sources. Suddenly their tongues come out, some kind of...
They end up swallowing their tongues and worms come out from the swallowed tongues and basically eat them out from the inside.
I mean, like just the fact that...
I know that.
Right, that Rabbi Mike Foyer says that, that's because it's written and it's like, whoa, that is the description of people who said something very, very, really upset God.
Well, it's very specific because it's what's called midah keneged midah, right? The idea is that when divine punishment manifests in the world, it's measure for measure. Right, that's where that phrase, of course, comes from, right? And in this case, they literally swallow their tongue, okay? Because this sort of like evil framing that speech gives them the power to do, right? Because as soon as you release your listen, we all have fears, we all have prejudices and framings that we use to understand the world. But God had said, no, listen, it's where we're going. I'm giving it to you, like you said, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. This is where you belong. To use your speech to corrupt that is to literally eat yourself out from the inside. Because what do you have left then? In your sophisticated speech and your ability to incite and enchant people to some illusion that's feeding your needs. In the end of the day, You've just created falsehood and you've rejected what's true, and that will inevitably eat itself out from the inside or rot.
So contrasted to that rot are two men. And these two men they have a different mindset. They have a different spiritual makeup. They have a different something.
They just see the world in a different light.
They see it in a different light. And we have two people. They're leaders. One is Yoshua bin Nun, right? He is Moses' faithful follower. But even so, even though he's considered, you know, one of the greats, Moses is going to change his name before he gets to the land of Israel. And he's going to say, you need a yud. And what's that yud? That's the yud of Sarimeno. You're going to be connected to the forefathers and mothers. You're going to be connected to Sarah. And Kalev ben Yefuneh, he doesn't get a name change, but he himself goes to connect with Avraham and Sarah. He goes to Hebron.
He lays down on their graves to pray, to be saved from the whole perspective that his fellow spies were. Jenny, imagine when the conversation was on the campfire. They were gone for 40 days, right? Imagine at night, they're like, go back, we're scared. Maybe there was conspiracy. This is a bad idea. This is what we can tell them. Who knows? And he just went there to pray to be just be saved from that whole vision.
There is one thing that Kalev does and Yoshua ben Nun do that, you know, I don't like to do so much, and that is they rend their clothes. Have you ever rent your clothes?
Yes.
Right.
Actually.
Right.
Once in my life.
You know, you're supposed to rend your clothes if you haven't been to the Kotel for like 30 days.
So. Actually, so twice. I did that once as well. Uh-huh. Although there are de'ot that are, you know, with the exception of the Temple Mount, don't insist on doing that when you see Jerusalem or the cities of Yehuda.
I had this idea to create a line of clothing that we would sell as you come to the Kotel called Wear and Tear. And you would put on this T-shirt and it would be like pre-perforated.
Yeah, which is really satisfying.
And you would just
of.
Like rip it, and then you would keep that T-shirt, be like, I ripped this when I saw the Western Wall.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I like that idea. If anybody's interested, Ishai at thelandofisrael.com. We can start a little business. Maybe with you, Mike. Rabbi Mike. Okay. In any case, Kalev ben Yefuneh and Yoshua ben Nun, they rend their clothes when they're back in the camp. And they're blown away by the fact that the other 10 spies don't only voice their opinion, but really propagandize the nation and cause them to fear. Now, what people don't know oftentimes is with regard to Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, most people understand that it's either that on Tisha B'Av we have to repent for the sin of Sinat Chinam, of just baseless hate between Jews. And others say that we have to repent for the temple being destroyed in general. And the
mourning.
Three,
it's not just repentance. It's a big mourning.
Mourning for the destruction of Jerusalem. But what people don't know, and the Talmud lays this out clearly, is that the root of Tisha B'Av is that very night when the Jewish people cried a false and unnecessary, uncalled for crying, God says, oh, that night when you rejected the land of Israel, when I was about to give you the biggest present and you turned it around and propagandized it and saw it in a dark way, that very night was the ninth of Tisha B'Av. You cried for a falsity. You will now cry twice for very real destruction.
Because in that moment, they let death back into the world. You know, it's not for naught that the symbolism, you know, of Yehoshua and Kalev ripping their clothing, as you said, is not just what people do when they see the Temple Mount. Like when I said I've done it once in my life, it was for my father, Alav Shalom, when he died. And that's what, and if a person should be in the presence of any person that dies, our tradition is if you're actually there when the soul leaves the body, you tear your clothing, right? So Yehoshua and Kalev rip their clothes. Moshe and Aaron fall on their faces, literally just dumbstruck. The spies swallow their tongues and rot to death on the ground, right? And then for the next 40 years, on every Tisha B'Av, what happens at night? Do you know what the Midrash says?
They would dig their own graves and lie down in it.
That's right. And then they would get up in the morning, and anyone who didn't rise, they would cover them over and move on. Right? Because in this moment, they let death back in the world. And that's where, by the way, the punishment that you mentioned of the golden calf being the Mishkan is only half the story. Because there was a promise there at the golden calf. Because they let death back into the world as well. Because when God gives the Torah at Sinai, in that just incomprehensible moment of true divine intimacy with the people, right? That they say, Paskazu Hama Dinachash, that the filth of the snake was removed, and that the sin of Adam, the first man who brought death in the world, had been erased, and that there was a moment of eternality. And then blew it. Right? And God says that I'm going to reap the rewards, or I'm going to really give the punishment for this moment little by little throughout history. And that the sages bring that
long suffering,
but the sages bring specifically that this whole failure of the spies had been waiting to happen. That it's really the sort of culmination of what had happened there with the Golden Calf, and that is letting death back into the world. And if you think about it in this level of the narrative, of the undermining of not just what's actually true, but the ability to know truth at all, right? And that's what it is to really be motzi diba in Hebrew, like they say. Because Rashi points out, listen, diba is neither true nor false intrinsically. It's just carrying words around. And if you take the truest words and you put them in the wrong context, it's slander. Sometimes it's actual true falsehood. You know, sometimes it's just saying something which is true and seeming well-meaning, but at the right time. Right? That's why the law forbids actually praising someone in front of someone you know that doesn't like them. Well, how come I'm not able to say, Yish, I want to mensch that guy. Yes, I love him. He's so articulate. He's kind. He's generous. I happen to know the person that you're talking to doesn't like you. That's forbidden. Why? Because the whole time I'm arousing their hatred in their heart. But wait, I'm not only saying everything that's true, I'm actually praising you. No. It has nothing to do with it. Because the context that you've carried those words into is what gives them their impact in the world. That's what these spies are doing. They're just carrying all these words around, and that is also a type of death.
You know, Rabbi Mike, I know a rabbi in America, in a certain town. I know his name. I know who he is.
Don't release his address
on air. I won't, but I can tell you that this man is a rabbi and actually quite bright. Many of the things that he tells his congregants are related to the things that the spies told. The fear, you won't be able to teach your children Torah, you won't be able to make it. And he actively does this.
This narrative is alive and well in Israel. It has not gone away.
Right.
It has had a tremendous rebirth, as has the spirit of Yehoshua and Kalev.
Right.
Right? The spirit of those who are around us here building this land and growing if you go around the corner here, I don't know if you've ever noticed it, that there's someone who put in plaster and tile into the side of their wall with Tova Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od.
That's right.
Have you noticed it there on the corner?
Yeah, it's a very good land. The land is good.
Very, very, very good.
That's right. By the way, there's a wine out of Hebron called Tova Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od. That's like a wine.
Yeah?
You could buy that wine.
That's
a
good gift to give people.
Yeah, it's great. And it does great in America. It really connects folks. This parsha has so much to do with the time that we're living in that you're pointing it out. By the way, we are living here in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, at least at this moment right now, and you can be part of the story when you tune into thelandofisrael.com and the Yishai Fleischer Show, certainly. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Rabbi Mike Foyer, you're at sulamyakov.com. You also have a new effort towards teaching people Jewish history.
I'm really excited. I am telling the story of Jewish history in 30 parts. It's like an audio chapters. I've got a book. It's a class I've been teaching for 8 years. It's about the fact that there is no word for history in Hebrew, and that what the Jews are doing is creating a memory which can shape present identity that can carry us into that redeemed future we want. So anybody out there who's looking to understand Jewish history from the book of Daniel through the expulsion from Spain, that's the first 30-part series. I have a crowdfunding campaign to get 30 professional quality podcasts off the ground. We're already 2/3 of the way there. It's really exciting. If you're interested to connect to that project, you can find me, Rob Mike Foyer, on Facebook. You can send me an email at info@sulamyakov.com. You can go to the
info@sulamyakov.com.
Yes, info@sulamyakov.com. You can go to the platform Patreon, Patreon, and just search for Foyer, and you'll find me there. And I'm just really excited to tell this story. It's something I've been burning with a long time.
You have an opportunity to really get a grasp on Jewish history and be part of Rabbi Mike's...
For as little as $1 a podcast.
All right, check that out, definitely. And at sulamyakov.com is the easiest way to begin the trip.
For sure.
All right, so you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Jerusalem Hot Day. As I was telling you, buried Irving Moskowitz yesterday. And the Torah portion that we're talking about is Parshat Shlach. It's the book of Numbers. Chapter 13 is where it begins. And basically, you have, by the way, the word Eretz, the root land, is exactly 40 days in the Torah portion. If you count it, it's exactly 40 times. And it's exactly 40 days that the spies were in the land. It's exactly 40 years that they were punished to be in the desert and not get into the land. Also within this, Moses kind of tells us later on in the book of Deuteronomy in Devarim that, yeah, the frontal excuse of why I'm not going to the land of Israel is the smashing, hitting the rock and not talking to him. But the real deal is that I was punished along with you guys with this generation. This generation did not merit to go into the land of Israel. And I saw by the Chalban, a great genius that lives today, who's called the Milkman Rabbi, he said also that Moses could have gone into the land of Israel, but he bound himself with that generation. Mm. He was their father and their mother, and he, in a sense, chose to go down with them as opposed to go into the land and kind of jump over them. No, he was their father, and he wasn't going to let them go.
Well, far be it for me to argue, but to me, the big question I'm always holding here, which I mentioned before, is that if it was a punishment, then whose fault was it? You know, if you're going to punish a family, you punish the father and mother, you punish the children, right? And it really revolves around this question of who sent these spies. In the simple reading of our parsha, it says, God says, Shlach Lecha. And in the easiest reading, how would you translate that?
Go ahead, send it.
Send them. Right, it's a command even. It seems to be a command for him.
Right?
Send them, right? Okay, fine. Then in that description of Deuteronomy you're speaking about, Moshe says, whose idea was it?
It was your idea.
You came, well, careful. He says, you came to me and said we want to do it, and then I sent them, right? Which is there was some kind of shared thing. And Rashi, obviously in his genius, brings here in our parasha a very simple explanation, which is that, what does shlach lecha mean? People read this as apologetic, and in my opinion, that's because they're latur b'Torah. They're out there with their frameworks trying to make it say what they want as opposed to reading what it says, right? Rashi says, you know what, Moshe, it's up to you. That's what it means, shlach lecha. You send, Moshe. You ask me, I'm not giving you an answer. And you have to realize the tremendous shift in the relationship between Moshe and Kodesh Baruch Hu that this represents. Up until now, every time Moshe didn't know what to do, and even when he did, what would he do before he did anything? Ask God. And God has told him, right? We've spoken about it before. I'm going to dial in for the download in the Benot Slofchad and the you know, second Pesach and all this story. Now suddenly Moshe dials in and says, God, and we're getting the real description of it in Devarim. They came to me. They want to send spies. Okay, what should I do? God says, I don't know, Moshe. What should you do?
Well, isn't that the quintessential coming into the land of Israel?
Wow. And that's how I understand the fact that, no, Moshe, it wasn't a punishment. It was a consequence. He bound himself. I don't think he could have gone. Moshe was the redeemer and the product of that generation. Of course he could have gone. But what did he fail to do here? I think he failed to speak to their fear. When they came to him and said, Moshe, we want to send spies, perhaps what he should have said is, but why?
Right. Have faith.
Yeah, or just simply why, right. And get them to speak out that fear, and just listen to the fear. And this is, you want to talk about how this parsha is the parsha of our time? That's what needs to happen. You know, we were just in LA, and I did manage to have a couple of conversations with people about, but why? Yeah, I hear you saying to me that you want to be in Israel, and yet here you are, and many of them deepening their connection in America. But why? And you know, it always comes down to fear. Not necessarily fear of bombs and terrorists, or it could be fear of children's education, it could be fear of it all comes down to fear of the unknown, uncertainty in my own abilities, you know, and the factors that I've built up with all those words that I carry from here and there and construct my world comfortably. And by the way, don't undervalue the role that fear plays in being comfortable with your world, because it lets you ignore things, right? And so maybe what Moshe should have just said, well, tell me, what? You're afraid? They've been slaves for 40 years. This is not a rational process.
That's right. That's right. They were still stuck in their fear narratives and their fear paradigms. But two men were not.
That's right.
And those two men, I want to say two things about those two men. One is that the deepest level to understand, one of the deepest levels to understand that amazing union of Kalev and Yeshua was that one was the scion of the Judean dynasty and later the Davidic dynasty, and one was from the Joseph tribes. And we have a concept of two Mashiachs together working in tandem. Mashiach ben Yosef.
Which is rooted in them.
Exactly. And Mashiach ben David. When these two forces can work together, he's not ben David, but he is related to David. He's one of the fathers.
No, I was just questioning myself. It's actually not rooted in them. It's rooted in Yeshua and Yehuda and Yosef, like you said.
It's one of the roots. It's one of the roots here. Yeah, one of the proofs of the incredible force and power that when Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David can work together. That unity. It can cut through 10 other spies, a whole nation that's against them, a giants in the land. It can also cut through time. 40 years they're going to be in the desert. These two men are going to lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. They're going to lead it. And God says about Kalev, Kalev ben Yefuneh, he says about him that you had a ruach acheret. A different spirit. And I always ask people, what kind of thing is that? Imagine you came to the class to your son's or daughter's teacher. They said, yeah, Mikey's got, he's a little different. It's not exactly the best compliment. And I always wonder, like, what, I wondered for years, what does this mean, ruach acheret? You should have said, ruach netzach, he had a victorious spirit, a ruach elokim, he had a godly spirit.
Ruach,
whatever, some kind of awesome ruach.
Just says, different.
Ruach acheret. I thought about it, and Kodesh Baruch Hu gave me an idea. And that is that I split up the word acheret to two words. Achar, tough.
Mm-hmm.
Post, tough. Tough is also 400 in the numerical equation.
For sure.
He was post 400. 400 is the exile. He was post exile. He was not there. He was like, I'm already there. I'm not stuck in the past. I'm not with the Holocaust and I'm not with the slavery. I'm already there. I just give me the chance. I'm totally ready to go.
Yeah, and therefore he has absolute confidence that the process will work.
Right, and he's not there. He's not in the other place. They wanted to go literally back to the other place.
Yeah.
They wanted to go to the other place. Well, and one last thought about this, and I want to get your comments on this, Rabbi Mike, is that amazingly in this Torah portion, which is tragic, certainly tragic, heartbreaker, real heartbreaker.
It's a real heartbreaker.
We're talking about the loss of a generation. We're talking about great people going down. And yet, within this very Torah portion are a few other, lights, tinklings, right?
Gems.
Twinklings is what I meant, little twinkles. And the little stars. One of them is, when you come into the land, the first bread that you make, give me a portion of it. As in, wink, wink, you will go into the land.
Right.
And this is the commandments that I want you to fulfill. And also, the incredible commandment of tzitzit, of a four-cornered garment, which makes you look Jewish, and especially in the lower extremities, keeps you remembering that you're Jewish, and has in it the priestly weave, the priestly strand of the tchelet, the blue that's made from the Murex trunculi snail.
And what role does that blue
serve?
Did
I say that right?
I'm not sure.
Whatever. You know, the little blue snail. Go to tekhelet.com, tchelet.com, or .org, and learn more about this incredible mitzvah.
And if you're in the land of Israel, it's really worth it to go snorkeling with the organization there.
Murex trunculi?
I don't know. I keep up on biology. Right, you're so the mother, is the
that's
marine
right.
biologist.
That's right. So those two commandments and others about telling you that you will be in the land, you will make it, and that you are a special people unto me. It's not all over in this Torah portion.
It is definitely not all over, and that has so much to do with that power of Kalev that you were speaking about, that he, it's not just that I'm not in that exile mentality anymore. I'm already in the land, because if that were the case, then he would have been broken by the decree of 40 years. He would have said, what? No, but I was there, Tov Ma'od, and that would leave him to despair. I mean, we see this, right? You know, there is so much of a sense in this country, not so much, but there's a certain layer of this country that is embittered because it didn't just happen, right? In 1948 or 1967.
Right, the window was open, and the door was open, we missed it.
And we missed it, and now it's just all over. And unfortunately, I'm sure you've encountered this.
It's a type of post-Zionism.
It's a type of post-Zionism, which is most commonly found by people who would define themselves as Zionists.
Right.
They're just a little bit embittered, and there's a sense of tiredness, right? Whereas Kalev, his commitment was to the fact that the process is one thing, but the goal is unchanging. So he's no, we're there. We made the process. I'm there. I'm down. It's not going to happen? And that's why it cuts through time. He says, okay. But, I'm still there. Okay, process it. And that's why he says, that God actually says, right, that he didn't stray from after me. Me'achorai. Right? And that achorai brings back the deepest vision that humanity has ever had of God, right? When Moshe's there on the mountain, after the forgiveness for the sin of the golden calf, he says, "Hareini na kvodecha," right? Show me your full glory, God. And says, God says, "Whoa, no, sorry. You know, you can't see Adam lo yirani v'chai." But what will he show him? Achorai. I'll show you from behind. What does that mean? Is that the full manifestation of God in the world in creation is not comprehensible to the human being. But if you can embrace its unfolding in the process, that back, at the back end, as the software engineers will tell you, how it's actually all coming to manifestation, then you're always hooked in. You're always hooked into the goal. It just hasn't manifest yet.
I just want to give one tiny proof for what you just said.
Yeah?
You are so, so right, but I don't know if you even thought of this proof. What you just said about Khalef Ben Yefuneh, that he was not weak in any way, at the age of 85, he says, I think it's chapter 14 of the book of Joshua, he says, my strength is today as it was before, to come in and go.
Specifically to when they came back with the report of the spies.
Right.
Yep.
He says, I'm still just as strong today, and I'm ready to go in.
Yep.
He wasn't marred, bittered, embittered. You know, that's a lesson for all of us. We hit snags. We hit snags. And it's not so easy to keep on going. You sometimes just say, this avenue and this pathway is too messed up. It's too hard.
And therefore, the goal is not worth it. And that's the clarity that he's holding. And I feel like the Yehoshua is holding it in equally deeply, but in a very different way, because, of course, he's completely silent right now. Right? Khalev takes it to the people. He engages the argument, and he expresses both here and, as you pointed out, in Yehoshua so beautifully. It's a great proof that he has not wavered. Yehoshua doesn't even need to speak about it. He's like, listen, I was there when Moshe came down from the mountain with the Torah. I don't really know what you people are doing right now. It's not going to go well, but we're going to the land.
Right, and I'm
going
to lead you.
And I will lead you.
That's right.
I will lead you.
All right, folks, speaking of leadership, we are all leaders in our lives. We also are very lucky to have great people, thinkers, rabbis, and don't let it be told to you that this is a leaderless time. There are great people in our time. I see them all the time. Next week, I'm going to broadcast to you from some of the Shurat HaDin Israel Law Center conference of amazing people who are taking the fight to the enemy. And the rest of the show today is going to have a focus on two great people. One, Irving Moskowitz, that we started talking about in the beginning of the show today, and Alan Weinkrantz, who passed away this week from natural causes. Irving Moskowitz and Alan Weinkrantz in a tragic accident, but we will hear his voice. It'll keep on having that life and that strength through our rebroadcasting it and internalizing it. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you so much. Please check out sulamyakov.com for your 30-part mini-series on history that you can support on Patreon. Check it out.
And Rav Mike Foyer on Facebook.
Rav Mike Foyer at Facebook. Very good. And, of course, stay connected with me, YishaiFleischer.com. Somebody asked me if they wanted to donate just to me directly. Of course, YishaiFleischer.com/donate. But thelandofisrael.com has many great programs, including our new program with Shlomo Katz.
I have such great news.
That is amazing. Rabbi Shlomo Katz is going to be on board as well, and more great people are coming. So you are really plugged in and tuned in to, I think, the Premier Network. There are other ones that are doing great work as well. God bless all of the good voices out of Israel, but you certainly are plugged into an amazing operation. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Stay connected on Twitter, Facebook, and any other way. Most importantly, this week, my homework for you, Jew or Gentile, read the Torah portion. We always say, from your mouth to God's ears, and I always say, from God's mouth to your ears.
Amen.
Take that for a second. Read the Torah portion, chapter 13 and on, in the book of Numbers. Let it talk to you and be part of the story. Stay tuned. Here is my report from the funeral of Irving Moskowitz. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much.
Shabbat shalom, Yishai.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. I am walking down from Mount Scopus area, Beit Orot Yeshiva. We are following the body of one Dr. Irving Moskowitz. Some people have called him the Moses Montefiore of today, a man who's given untold amount of money, but also support more than money, with regard to Jewish building in Eastern Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, places like Hebron. There's a huge procession that's following him right now. Danny Danone, Ambassador Danny Danone, flew in for this. We're about to follow some police vehicles and others that are going to take us through the top of the Mount of Olives, the Atur neighborhood, which is sometimes dangerous, in order to bring Dr. Irving Moskowitz to his final resting place on the Mount of Olives, close to the tomb of Rav Kook, Rav Isaac Yitzchak Kook, who is buried on the Mount of Olives in the Prophets section. I'm here with Doron Spielman, who is the Vice President of the City of David. Doron, Dr. Irving Moskowitz was not just a donor. It's much more like some kind of father figure to the whole enterprise of Jewish building in Eastern Jerusalem. Is that an overcharacterization?
No, actually, I'd say that, that's correct. In the same way that a father takes his son or his daughter at an early stage in life and gives them the first kind of direction, sees their potential, and is the initial one to really direct them, that was actually Dr. Moskowitz. He wasn't somebody who joined a ship as it was already flowing down the river. He actually started the ship.
So at this funeral, it's like a veritable who's who of the development of Eastern Jerusalem, Hebron, places like Jaffa and Akko. It's really a who's who of what people would call sometimes the right wing, the nationalist movement. Your boss is a famed person named David Laberry, who is the pioneer of the City of David. Right now, it's already become a very normalized kind of place in the consciousness of Israelis and tourists from abroad. But not so long ago, it was not in the mainstream. How did Dr. Moskowitz help Davidala and yourself and the City of David become part of the mainstream consciousness of Israel?
Well, one of the things that Davidala told during the funeral in his eulogy was that in the very first days, when one considers entering a place like the City of David, which had been owned by Baron Rothschild, but essentially via neglect and Jordan's illegal occupation of Jerusalem, became a very dangerous Arab village. When Davidala was considering entering the City of David, he looked around him. He spoke to the top lawyers in the country. He spoke to the top figures. He explained that this was originally Jewish land. And the answers he received from everybody was no, there's no way you can go in. If you go in, even though you have a legal right, you're going to get thrown out. So Davidala said to himself, look, all the facts, all the intelligence about this place are telling me this can't be done. And as a soldier, I go on intelligence, I go on facts. But he said, I want to consult one other person, a person that combines both facts and intelligence with faith and with a greater understanding. And he went to Dr. Moskowitz and asked him his advice. And Dr. Moskowitz said, Davidala, there are sometimes, there are moments, there are historic moments. And in those moments, you look beyond the facts. And Jerusalem is a place that is more powerful than the facts. It is more powerful than our enemies. If you believe in this, then go do this. I will help you and it will be done. And that's how the City of David was made, in his great merit.
That is a very powerful story. And I heard that theme a few times in the eulogies, that basically he put Jerusalem above everything. You know, a lot of times people tell you today, why do you put land above other values? What's the importance of land? You know, where people have existed without a land for a long time? Are you sacrificing your liberal values and other values? I get that all the time. I was just talking to J Street. They were hitting me with that recurrently. What brings a person who's a doctor, also, you know, one established like a bingo kingdom. What gets him to understand that Jerusalem is above everything? Where does that consciousness come from?
Well, I'll tell you that I think what we heard tonight was that Dr. Moskowitz was above everything else an incredibly humble and modest person. And via that humility, he didn't allow his money, his great wealth, to cloud his judgment. He understood one thing about the land, that the Jewish people, each of us, are like seeds. And there's only one plot of land, only one soil where we can really grow. It's not the soil of Poland. It's not the soil of Germany. It's not even the soil of America. It's only the soil of Eretz Yisrael. And he understood that so deeply that he knew that buying the land of Eretz Yisrael was the only way that the seedlings of the Jewish people could go. And for that, he was willing to dedicate his entire life.
Doron Spielman, Vice President of City of David. Thank you.
Thank you, Yishai. Kol hakavod.
Going to be going over the top of the Mount of Olives to the Prophets section where Rabbi Cook is buried, and soon Dr. Irving Moskowitz is going to be buried right next to him as well. I spoke just now with the City of David folks, and now another organization which has benefited so much from the support of Dr. Moskowitz is the Ateret Kohanim organization, which really reclaims land both in the Old City of Jerusalem and also in its environs. And Daniel Lurie is the executive director there. Daniel, I'm looking for stories about Dr. Moskowitz. I'm looking to understand who this man really was and what motivated a doctor from Miami Beach to be so plugged into the story of Jerusalem.
In every generation, there is, thank God, someone who can take on the mantle of bring a pillar, a prince of Jerusalem. Some say he had the key to Jerusalem. He was a man of Jerusalem. You know, every part of his body, the statement "Libi b'Mizrach" for him was very, very real. He felt the pulse of the city, felt the pulse of the nation, and therefore did whatever was necessary from the very first check he wrote out after Rabbi Dolgan actually introduced Matidan to Dr. Moscovich. At the time, he was the head of the JNF, and Mati had just written out a check, and he had no real way to cover the check. But he had a few days up his sleeve, so he goes back to Rabbi Dolgan from Los Angeles, who initially had told him, American Jews aren't going to do this type of work of reclamation or redemption work. But he had this check in his hand that he'd just written out for this Arab. Rabbi Dolgan said, well, there's this one man who's a little bit gung-ho and he's a serious guy for the JNF. Speak to him. As it works out, Dr. Moscovich had actually landed that particular morning in Netanya, where he had our holiday house. Mati rings him up, and without asking for any letters or recommendations or who are you or send me a fax, he said, meet me at the King David, I'm coming. It sounds unbelievable. This was actually to buy the very first building in the old Jewish quarter, today known as Shuvu Banim, a Braslav Yeshiva. Then it was known as Yeshivat Chaye Olam. He came, he walked in the alleyways of the old city, he saw the old mezuzahs from when the Jews were driven out. From that point in time, there was a love affair with Jerusalem, with the alleyways, with the homes, with the yeshivot, the old homes, the old yeshivot. It was more than just feeling the pulse of Jerusalem. He was Jerusalem, you know, and the world may have been against him. I mean, the biggest story, obviously, is the Jewel in the Crown project of Ateret Konim and Malei Azeitim. There was even internet sites set up against him, Stop Moscovich Now, EU, UN, pressure from America, the Arab League, every single one. Arafat Yamach Shamay said, the only Jews he will ever allow are the dead Jews in Har Azeitim. Moscovich had determination, passion and drive and Jerusalem running through his veins, and no one was going to say no. He wasn't just someone that gave to Ateret Konim. He was a partner of Jerusalem. Maybe he was God's messenger, I think, on this world to do what is necessary. And God had his roadmap. And on God's roadmap, Moscovich was the one leading the pack. Israel, Jerusalem, you know, if the stones of Jerusalem could talk, they would say... we've been dirty and dusty and barren for 2,000 years. The second that Moscovich started walking through the alleyways of Jerusalem, we've seen life. He brought life to Jerusalem.
Very powerful words. Very powerful words. And I wonder again, where does the motivation come from, Daniel Lurie? Where does a person get it?
I think...
As opposed to others who don't get it.
I think part of it, and I don't think he ever verbalized it. One time he mentioned to me something about, his immediate family was killed by the Holocaust, but there was no question that losing over 100 members of his family by the Nazis, being told the Jews can't live somewhere, impacted him tremendously, and there was no way the Jews weren't going to have a safe, secure haven, and even more so, no one was going to tell him that a place should be Judenrein, free of Jews. That was a very foreign concept, and so he basically lived the concept of Jews have a right, historical, moral and ethical to live anywhere, especially in our own land, especially in our own city, and even more so in a place where Jews were kicked out of with the pogroms and riots. So it were many things that drove him. It was God, it was his belief, it was unwavering, unmoving, uncompromising. There was one Jerusalem, united Jerusalem, there was one Jewish people, and he was part of it. Every fiber of his body.
Daniel Lurie, Executive Director of Ateret Konim, thank you. Ben Packer is the director of the Jerusalem Heritage House. We're walking down right now on the top of the Mount of Olives towards the Seven Arches Hotel. Just a few minutes, we're going to be burying Dr. Irving Moscovich. You told me something very interesting. You told me that his greatness was not only in that he recognized the importance of Jerusalem and gave money towards it and gave direction towards it, but also that he was willing to take it on the chin, willing to get his name sullied in the papers and dirtied and called names. You think that was one of his greatest attributes?
Yeah, even in this world today, there's abuse from all directions. Social media, internet, media. He didn't care. He did it anyway. He knew he was going to get abuse, and he kept going and kept going. He didn't apologize. He said what was right, and he kept doing what was right. And people kept abusing, and he just he took it for everybody else. Can't compare to previous generations. Nobody ever took abuse like this man took. Try to find anybody who took abuse like him. Nobody took abuse like him. And he kept going anyway, till the very end.
So you're saying that in our time, you kind of get more, the forces of evil have more of a say, they can hurt your family, the names that they call you, the image that they kind of create for you. There was a, of course, famous website called Stop Moscovich. And you told me that you saw one time an article written about him in the Miami Herald.
The Miami Herald wrote an article. He was already sick. And they called him different names, described him in ways that weren't accurate. The man can't respond. He was ill. What kind of sickness is that? I joined their newsletter just so I could complain to them how sick it was. But this is part of Mesiris Nefesh. He embodied Mesiris Nefesh. He put his money where his mouth was, where his actions were. Nobody can compare. There's no comparison today. Today somebody buys a house, Somali's 18, does something. Baruch Hashem, they're a tzaddik. But you can't compare. He put everything on the line. He could have lost everything every time. He won every time.
Thanks, Ben. Elyon Shemesh is a good friend and the director of development for Yeshivat Har Amor North America. Elyon, we're standing right now on the angle down from the Mount of Olives. This is basically where the paratroopers ran down from the top of the Mount of Olives from Augusta Victoria into the Lion's Gate over there. Clearly we see the humongous golden dome right there and the whole plaza of the Temple Mount from Second Temple. And we're here because we're not just enjoying the sights and praying today, we're also burying a dear person, a person who, like us, saw this, but also wanted to see more Jews here, more development here, more strength here. What can you tell me about Irving Moskowitz?
I'll tell you two stories. You know, I've had the great honor of being a director of development for many Zionist organizations, and every organization I've worked for, him and Cherna were involved in supporting financially. And just tell you one story she told me. Cherna told me that when she first began to redeem the homes of Jerusalem, she couldn't believe the prices they were paying for what we call a hole in the wall. And she said to Irving, how could you pay this amount of money for this, you know, dump? And he said, every stone in Jerusalem is a Rembrandt. That's what she told me. And I want to tell you now another story that happened. This story happened about 2 years ago. I was at I went to the home of Charna and Dr. Irving in Florida. And I brought my guitar. And at that state already, it's been a few years since Mr. Moskowitz was not so functional. You know, he had Alzheimer's and he wasn't so aware of what was going around him. And he wasn't interacting too much with the surroundings. But I knew that if I come with my guitar and I play songs about Jerusalem, it's going to do something to him, because it was so deep in his soul, the connection to Jerusalem, that there's nothing else that would arouse him. So I came and I started singing songs of Jerusalem, Uvnei Yerushalayim, and I saw the most unbelievable thing. He started tapping his hand on his leg. As I was playing, his hand started to tap. First time where he was interacting. And then he actually reached over to Cherna and reached his hand over to her, calling her. And I said to Cherna, do you understand? He wants to dance with you. They got up and danced for a half an hour straight. And Cherna was crying her heart out, her eyes out. And I could not believe it. And this is a story that happened with me 2 years ago firsthand.
You know, Elyon, I've been looking for stories today. That's all I've been saying to people. I'm like, tell me a story. Don't tell me about how. That's a great story. That's a moving story. That's a very, very true story. It shows that the relationship that Dr. Moskowitz had to Jerusalem and to Cherna was not just, you know, something that they did support it, but something that was deep in the heart. Elyon, thank you very much. Let's go right now together to these great tents facing the Temple Mount right now in Jerusalem on a very hot summer day here in Jerusalem, and yet somehow the crowd seems energized to give the last respects to this great man. Thank you, Elyon.
You're welcome.
As his son, growing up, and later as an adult, I always wanted to understand what were his guiding principles and values that he had and used in his life that helped him become what he became. The success and accomplishments were a result of a life based on these principles. In essence, we were his immediate family, but all of you, the Jewish people, were also his family. And here's why. Our father had very deep religious feelings, very, very strong religious feelings. He ran a fantastic Seder. Of course, this is all from the perspective of a kid. First, it started with a big shopping in Los Angeles. I don't think my father ever went shopping before to go food shopping, but somehow Pesach was different. At that time, we lived in Long Beach, California, where there wasn't any kosher shopping area. So you had to schlep all the way to Los Angeles. Shopping with Dad was so much fun because you got to get whatever you wanted. we would go through the aisle and he would let us pull all the candy and kosher for Pesach stuff in the wagon, things that Mom would never allow. He knew too that we had too many halvas and candy fruit slices. We brought home all the kosher for Pesach food. He made it so much fun. He made it such a wonderful experience. It was precious and very sweet time for all of us. Then he would read through the whole Seder with the Nusach Nigin that Zaidi taught him. He also emphasized Israel wherever it came up. Specifically, where was the place that Rabbi Akiva and his Chavarim held their Seder? B'nai Brak? Do you children know that this is a place in Israel today called B'nai Brak? He always connected the land, the history, and our continuous Judaism and Torah. Eventually, we got to the Afikoman. We made a great deal out of hiding it for us in these ingenious places that only he could find with his riddles that he provided. For a little kid, it was the highlight of the night. It was an incredible time of family and celebrating our values. When I was 18 years old, I went to Yeshiva College and I wanted to become a rabbi. My parents had been pushing and discussing that I attend college and pursue a different career, eventually possibly going to law school. One afternoon, our father and I went for a walk on the golf course, which was situated behind our house. We talked where I explained how I felt and what I wanted, to make a career as a teacher rabbi. He explains his concerns for Parnassa, and they were real concerns. But at the end, that he saw that my convictions were strong and that this is what I wanted, so he agreed and became very, very emotionally supportive and validated my choice. He had such generosity of spirit with his children, letting each one pursue their respective career choice. He was so proud of his sons, the rabbis, myself and Baruch. Many times during the year, we would come home, vacation, and would substitute for the local rabbi in Miami Beach. I remember how proud and happy he was when people congratulated him on our success. Dad, we are all grateful for your openness and acceptance of all of us, and letting all of us do what we want instead of pushing and making us do something else. He was very welcoming and accepting to everyone from his family, which included every Jew on the planet. He also was fearless and courageous. I remember traveling together with my father to Israel in February 1974 when I was 12 years old. There was an international convention of Israeli bonds. We're sitting at one of the dinners, and you have to realize there's probably maybe 1,000 people there, and one of the Israeli officials was speaking. I think it was either Shimon Peres or Yitzhak Rabin. The times were very tense, and only 3 months after the Yom Kippur War. I did not understand the speech, but I gathered that it had something about returning to Sinai or giving it to U.S. pressure. Our father got up and started calling them down, yelling that he was selling Israel and the Jewish people down the river. I, being a little kid, was frozen with my jaw open, amazed at what my dad was doing. He, at that moment, became my ultimate bigger-than-life hero. Such courage, not for himself, but for the Jewish people. This was in 1974. What did he really want for his family? He grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust, where we lost many, many relatives. The Shoah taught him three things that he told me many times. Number one, we will never be safe if we put our safety in the hands of others. We cannot rely on their assurances of our safety. Two, he told me that he believed in God and he felt that God gives us opportunities all the time. Just we need to grasp and seize the moment and do our share. He felt that we have the chance to come to Israel earlier, but we did not heed the call. Three, we need to do everything that we can and not wait for a miracle. We need to act, to do. At the time when he spoke, I questioned his faith, but later in life I realized that he's teaching me the greatest faith is when you do not ignore the chances, opportunities, and gifts that God gives you to help you succeed. May our beloved mother find the strength necessary to carry on his legacy. May we all be blessed to carry on his legacy, each and every one of us, the children, the grandchildren, and all of our nation. Chazak ve'amen.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We're here on the Mount of Olives, just finished burying Dr. Irving Moskowitz, and I'm here with Aryeh King, who is the director of the Israel Land Fund and the Jerusalem City Councilman. Aryeh, you were one of the people who spoke at the eulogies. You knew Dr. Moskowitz very well and went through a lot of adventures. I've been asking a lot of people about stories. Tell me who Dr. Moskowitz was, really.
You want a story? Just to understand. Before we started purchasing properties in Akko, in the old city of Akko, there was a property for sale. Never Jews lived in the old city of Akko. It was just a place for tourists. I took pictures. I went to the place, took pictures from outside. I sent it to him by email. And without even visiting once, studying once for 1 minute on this property, he said, I'm buying it. I asked him, don't you want to see it? Don't you want to be inside to see what's the view from the roof or the condition of the property? He told me, Arye, if Jews are not living in the old city, and by doing that, I don't care what the size and what's the cost of the building, I'm doing it. And it's what happened. And today, after 8 years of activity in the old city of Akko, we have today 30 people living, Jews living there, families, students. This is Dr. Moskovich was for me. I could pick up the phone anytime, Ishai, anytime, 2 o'clock after midnight in US time, okay? I'm not talking about Israel time, anytime. Send him email, he responded immediately. I don't understand, when did he add the time to sleep? I asked Cherna many times, when are you sleeping?
We're looking over Ma'aleh Zaitim, which is a neighborhood, a Jewish neighborhood within the Jerusalem neighborhood of Ras El Amud, a mostly Arab neighborhood. And when you eulogized Dr. Irving Moskowitz, you mentioned specifically Ma'aleh Zaitim a few times. What's the big deal about these structures here? Why did you mention it with regard to Dr. Moskowitz?
Ishai, Dr. Moskowitz and his wife decided a few years ago to buy their burial plots right here. Before there was a neighborhood here, or Ma'aleh Zaitim, or another neighborhood in the north called Bet Torot. There was a yeshiva there. Today, I decided to mention it because when they decided to buy this plot, people say that he is a dreamer, that we are visionaries without any, our legs are not on the ground, okay? And today, we're looking in front of us now, in front of us, Ishai, we see beautiful neighborhood with Israeli flags in Ma'aleh Adumim. And when we started the funeral in Bet Torot, another neighborhood. This is all the story of Dr. Irving Moskowitz. He was a person that believed that he can change, and his mouth were in the right place, and his heart was in the right place. And he was never embarrassed to say what he thinks. And after he said what he thinks, he put his money and he bought this property. This property, Ma'aleh Zaitim, this is where I started my, I would say, public life, my Jerusalem chapter in my life. And this was thanks to Dr. Moskowitz that trusted me, gave me a lot of responsibility, including dealing with this project and other projects later. So for me, this is where everything started, related to Jerusalem. This was, for me today, when I talked about Dr. Moskowitz, and today, knowing that later I'm going to bury his body in Mount of Olives, saying he's going to be my neighbor, in a meaning that I never thought about. I wished that he would make Aliyah, and live in Yemin Moshe, where they have a house, so I can meet him every day. And today we buried him, and for me, I don't see it as closing the circle. But it's another point now. We know not many people understand. When I drive my car, when I'm walking with you, Ishai, there are places that are belonging to him. People don't know it belongs to him. I cannot talk about it. It's starting from the area of Kever Rachel, and it's ending in the north of Jerusalem, even in north of the country, in Akko, in the Galilee. People really don't understand. Dr. Moskowitz is not just Jerusalem, is much more. Gush Katif, Golan Heights, everywhere. Hebron, everywhere. Everywhere. Gush Etzion, everywhere. And to express to the people what was for me Dr. Moskowitz, it's almost impossible. It's like his grandson today told me they want to write a book and it will be ready next year. I told him, forget it. No chance you can cover all of your grandfather's stories and projects in 1 year. There's no chance. And when I'm looking at Ma'aleh Zaitim, and we see the bicycles of the children at the path, and we see the flags, and we see beautiful neighborhood, this is all thanks to a person that walked against the the stream. He had his vision and he implemented it. And I was so honored to help him to do that. And knowing Cherna Moskowitz, his wife, the widow, I know that it's going to continue. And I know the grandchildren and his children. And I see how a person that started everything from overseas, from US, now we have children and grandchildren living in Eretz Israel. And he have his projects and properties all over Eretz Israel. I think we will see the continuation of his vision and of his heritage. And it will never stop.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. I hope that you enjoyed being part of the procession of burying Irving Moskowitz. And I don't think he's being buried. I think he's given us life. And it's the end of one man's life. But his children, as we heard, go on and on. All the children of Eastern Jerusalem, of Hebron, and all these other places, the Jewish people back in the land of Israel. His own family, of course. But let us dedicate ourselves to also being his family as well. His children, people who have learned from his clarity of loving the land of Israel. And speaking of loving the land of Israel, Alan Weinkrantz was a PR guru for Israel Technology. I got a chance to interview him less than a year ago on the Voice of Israel Network, which is no longer with us. But in any case, I got a chance to speak with him, but he is also no longer with us. And that is due to a horrible, tragic car accident that happened in Tel Aviv. Alan Weinkrantz was having dinner along with other people at a restaurant in Tel Aviv when a driver had a heart attack, swerved off the street and onto the people eating on the sidewalk, and Alan was killed. There's been a lot of this is truly tragic, not like when some criminal act happens. This was just a tragic event, and Alan's life was cut short. He was a big lover of Israel and pioneered a technology PR and the Innovation Nation kind of moniker for Israel. And I had a chance to speak to him. So here's another voice from the past. Here's the real voice of Alan Weinkrantz. May God rest his soul. May he find peace. We're sorry to have lost him. But here's our chance to get a little bit of glimpse into his life. Alan Weinkrantz has been connecting people to those connectors for the last 30 some odd years and 20 years in Israel. He is a tech PR and startup communications strategist. Now, those are a lot of words, but if you're a startup and you want to get your name out there, that's the name of the game. You got to make your product and your idea known. How do you do it? How do you get that idea out there? And Alan is going to help you think about your product, think about how to package it, and think about how to get it out to the world. Alan is not only a person who's thinking about technology, but he's also thinking about Israel and technology trends. Alan Weinkrantz, welcome so much to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Alan, Israel has been dubbed the startup nation, and that's because there's really a tremendous amount of startups here in Israel. There's been a lot of rationales given for why Israel is the startup nation, but given that fact that Israelis do start predominantly more than other nations, a lot of these startups. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that we're called that startup nation?
Okay, so I can give you the practical reason, then I can give you there's a spiritual reason. The practical reason is all the obvious things that I think have been already written about and covered. You know, it could be the army, it can be the you know, all the great schools here. It can also be, you know, the neighborhood that, you know, is here. I think there's actually something a little different. And it's also, you have to keep into perspective, the startup nation that I knew 20 years ago and the startup nation that I know today are very, very, very different. So I can go back in time a little bit and describe kind of my journey and my discovery of Israel.
Please do.
Okay, so it was just about 20 years ago. I did very standard, traditional media relations and PR. There was no social web. There was internet that you had to dial up to. It was very crude. It was mostly email. And I actually launched a company in Austin called DTM Corporation, which was involved in a pioneering area called rapid prototyping. Today, it's really known as, 3D printing, and it's become more and more democratized. Anyway, I wound up launching this company, got a lot of great press for them all over the world. They were delayed in actually developing and finishing up the product, and I became interested in the technology, and I reached out to a newsletter editor, because that, back then they had real newsletters, and he told me about this company in Israel called Cubital. And he said, you ought to reach out to them. So I tracked them down, called the company up blindly. I'd been to Israel. I was 16 years old, the standard trip, going to Israel, but I had no idea what was here. And my first phone call was, I just called him up and introduced myself. And he said, yeah, it sounds interesting. We're getting ready to launch in about 3 to 6 months. Call me in a couple of months. I'm interested. So I called him back. And I remember the first real serious call I had with him was they were coming to Detroit to a trade show, and he said, I'd like to meet you before we actually take you on. Fly to Detroit to come meet me. I said, I'm happy to meet you, but you need to cover my airfare. And he refused to pay my airfare, and I started yelling at him. Now, this is not a good way to do business with a prospective client. I said, what do you mean you want me to get on the airplane at my expense? You have no idea how much experience I have. I can help you guys. You have no idea. I don't know why I just kind of let loose on this guy. And little did I know that it actually was probably a good way to...
Well, let me explain to you what happened. Yeah. You unleashed an inner Israeli that you didn't know. and through that inner Israeliness, he was like, okay. What he thought to himself in a kind of sub-dialogue that was in his subconscious, he was like, this is one of our people.
Right.
I can do business with this guy. He's a straight shooter. He doesn't like to take BS from me. And I like that very much.
And so I wound up flying to Detroit, and we met. We got along fabulously. And I wound up launching the company, did a really good job. And it was interesting. I remember being in meetings with them, and they would all be speaking Hebrew. But it was interesting watching them work together and very much strategizing and very much, this is 20 years ago, so you have to just keep this into perspective. And I did a phenomenal job for them. And he said, you should really come to Israel. There's a lot of companies like ours that could really use your help, because the big PR firms, I was, a small boutique agency, they don't pay attention to us. They don't take us seriously. Mm. And I said, let me think about it. But, the idea of going on a plane, this 20 years ago, this far away from home and kids, anyway. Through some research I did, somebody said, you need to find, there's this guy in LA named John Medved. John Medved.
John Medved.
Yes, the John Medved.
Right. He's Michael Medved's brother.
Yeah.
And Michael Medved is a famous radio show host out of Seattle. And John Medved is a venture capitalist, and he's also the founder of a company that's making a lot of waves, which is called Our Crowd, which is this kind of...
They're the world's largest equity-based crowdfunding platform. They have actually invested in the last, 12 to 18 months, more money here than any other VC firm out of Israel. They have over $80 million. And I reached him on the phone, and he said, you need to come to Israel. He said, there's so much going on. He said, just come. He said, in fact, you're based in San Antonio, right? I go, yeah. He said, I have a good friend who does PR. He's from San Antonio. His name is Charlie Levine.
My good friend, Alava Shalom, Charlie Levine, who passed away about 40 days ago. And we even here on this very station and my show, we played an interview that I had done with Charlie a few months ago, and Charlie was a dear friend.
And Charlie was...
And a great PR man.
A really good... he was phenomenal. And he helped me. And he said, look, get on an airplane, spend a week, you'll be back home, and you can go have dinner at Mi Tierra when you get back. I go, how do you know about Mi Tierra? Mi Tierra is the famous Mexican restaurant in San Antonio. He grew up in San Antonio. I got on an airplane. He held seminars for me. And I just literally...
Who, Medved?
No.
Charlie.
Charlie. I mean, I paid him to do this, but we were, in theory, competitors, and he helped me.
Wow.
Unbelievable. That is Charlie. And I didn't do what he did, because he did a lot of the Jewish organizations and did a lot of, things for the government. And I literally... was kind of just on a big adventure. And so what took me through this adventure was really the evolution of, you know, these sort of traditionally big companies funded by, you know, big VC firms. But what I wound up doing was doing a good job, word gets out, and I started coming about, you know, once a year, twice a year, and I would hold seminars.
This was what year?
How
long ago was it?
20 years ago. So, you know, this is 2014.
94.
Yeah, 94, 95, 96.
There's an intifada. There are problems, right?
I got on a plane anyway. I remember coming anyway, and I would stay at the David Intercontinental, and I remember I was the only person on the sixth floor. I was one of 10 people in the whole hotel.
Wow.
And I said, I'm coming anyway. Wow. It became, you know, you get stuff gets in your blood, and I said, I'm going to come anyway. Even if there was no business, I came anyway. I just wanted to tell other people who had other interests, I'm coming anyway. And so what I found was you develop a niche and you develop an expertise. And so I started reaching out to the VC firms. And I didn't know who this guy was. Somebody by the name of Jaime Perez. I had no idea who he was. Recommended one of his companies come to see me, a company called Audio Codes. Small company, 30 people, and I was holding a seminar, and this guy walks in. He said, excuse me, I didn't register for your seminar. Can I come in anyway? I didn't know who this guy was. Said, yeah, sit down. So we wound up, he reaches out to me, and he says, look, I'd like for you to come by our offices. Would you think you could help us? I said, I don't know. What do you do? He says, we do something called VOIP. And I go, yeah, I know what it is, but I said, for companies? And he said, no. Yeah, these are for like real companies. For industry and for, we have this thing called carrier grade VoIP. I said, impossible. You can't do this. He said, no, just anyway, wound up doing a great job for Audio Codes. And one led to another, What I was winding up doing was working on platform technologies that really became the first wave of building out the infrastructure of it became the internet as we know it today.
The internet as we know it today.
No, I'm serious.
Right.
No.
Listen, so, VoIP, that's a VoIP. Yeah. That's basically major companies are using VoIP. Even the phone companies themselves are offering you VoIP.
So I worked on VoIP. I worked on Wi-Fi, a company called Enviro that was acquired by Intel. And I remember sitting in a room with the CEO and the VP of marketing arguing with him saying, this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. Now, I know that these computers are going to get smaller, but why would you want to walk around all the time with a wireless connection that's not dependable? Ethernet works fine. I plug it into the wall. It works fine. I thought cell phones, you know, I knew cell phones would eventually, you know, you'd get your data from a cell phone carrier, but Wi-Fi was kind of a dumb idea. Well, it turned out not to be such a dumb idea, and so I got to work on Wi-Fi. I got to work on early firewalls. I got to work on one of the first tablet computers.
Now, when you say work on them, what do you mean?
Oh, media relations and PR.
Right. So basically,
I'm not an engineer.
Right.
Meaning, we had to come up with why should what are called OEMs and ODMs. That's the original equipment manufacturers. Why should they take my client's technology and put it inside their box?
If you're making a computer, why do you need to include now Wi-Fi within the laptop?
Or the Wi-Fi chip specifically from Enviro. Or an IPTV chip that goes in a set-top box from a company called Coppergate Communications.
This is amazing stuff, and you've really been able to touch the technologies that really are the foundations of large chunks of our lives today. We're going to take a tiny break. We're speaking with Alan Weinkrantz of alanweinkrantz.com. He's a tech PR and startup communications strategist, and he's also a great Zionist in that he's teaching the world about what's coming out of Israel. We'll be right back after a short break talking about the foundations of the technology in your life and also in your heart. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way.
Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel, where prophecy meets reality. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's HAYOVEL.com, for more information.
And we're back, the Yishai Fleischer Show here, Voice of Israel, broadcasting from Jerusalem. We're talking about the creation of technologies and Israel's role in it. And Alan Weinkrantz has been a tech PR and startup communication strategist. That means that he's touched so many of the foundational technologies behind the lives that we live today. We were just talking about Wi-Fi and how he didn't believe in it in the beginning and how he ended up being pushing that technology as well. It's really teaching, isn't it? Isn't it PR and communication strategy? It's about educating people. It's about turning them on in a short amount of time. And you were telling the story about how you got into Israeli tech and PR.
Yeah, and so to continue this evolution of this journey, what I started to see was what was a typical company, 30 engineers and a CEO who happened to be the VP of marketing. He was the director of business development and the chief sales guy. What I started to see, though, was as this technology became more and more mainstream and I started to see more and more of these traditional, now you think of these startups that are, you know, two or three guys with a really good idea. And the thing is, today, you don't need all the servers. You can do things in the cloud. You can go to a company, for example, I'm actually sponsored by a company called Rackspace. So they're one of the leading hosting providers in the world. And in fact, that's why I'm here, is to help them explore the, you know, Israel market. And so, what I've been really doing over the past 4 to 5 years has been more involved in these are the startups that you think of today. And the difference between today and say 15 or 20 years ago is the dramatic cost reduction of going into business, the democratization of this technology. And so on this trip, especially, you know, in my mission for Rackspace, what I'm doing is I'm visiting all the accelerators. So what's really beneficial is I've really got a bird's eye view on the country, because I can go to all the various accelerators in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, in Nazareth, and here in Jerusalem. And I get to see rapid fire one-on-one really interesting companies. And so yesterday, for example, I was sitting all day at a place called Hack. It's the Herzliya Accelerator, which is to solve urban problems. I sat with 8 different companies and then did a seminar. Tomorrow, I'll be at a place called SOSA, which is, you would think you're in an urban, cool New York City, Soho, really cool, you know, place. I'm going to be working with I have seven companies I'm going to be mentoring.
Where is this place?
It's south of Salamain, it's in Tel Aviv. You know, kind of urban, kind of warehouse district. WeWork is also a partner with Rackspace. So I'm going to be, I was at WeWork last week. I'm working with the Jerusalem College of Technology. They're going to be coming online again with Rackspace. So you've got these accelerators all over the country. And I'll tell you what's different, and that I have this belief, is that aside from, you know, the cool traditional startups, I'm seeing more and more startups that are focused on solving human problems. Mm. And that is core and indigenous, that you cannot replicate anywhere else in the world. And that's what really inspires me when I'm here is, for example, there's one called EcoMotion, which we're going to be working with, that's solving transportation problems. There's another one, actually Jerusalem College of Technology has one for the Haredim.
The ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah, the ultra-Orthodox. And I've got this thing in my head that I believe that when you're going and you're spending most of your life studying, and that's really all you do, and all of a sudden you have a startup, I wonder if your brain is wired a little differently. And I wonder if you approach being creative in a different way and maybe in a spiritual way. So I'm able to see all these, you know, like there's one for health. There's all these different accelerators focused on solving social problems. There's one for education called Mindset. They're working on education, and my belief is that if you can prototype something one person at a time here in Israel, you can replicate it and make the world better by 8 billion other people. And where I got this from was taking audio codes, where if you get a design win at Bezeq, you can do the same thing at Deutsche Telekom, at AT&T. So it's the same thing that I did 20 years ago, except we're doing it with humanity. And that's where Israel's got this lead, And that's where Israel is a place that's making the world better. And I think it's just something indigenous, inherent, and just how this country is wired and why this sense of purpose, that if you can codify something for the social good and turn it into a business, all the better, and you're solving human problems, no one can replicate that. And that's where I think that this place is so special.
So it's the marriage of the mind to the heart. It's thinking about businesses, but it's using the brain to think about it, but with the heart, with solving problems, human problems. And I've heard of companies like this, like for example, Nest in America, who I heard was thinking about house heating and air conditioning and your fridges and things that we live with that could be made better, that could work better. And of course, you're talking about real problems like educational problems. There are so many people who are dyslexic and other things. So many people who clean water technology. Of course, Israel has been a leader at. There's so many ways to make the world a better place through technology. But to monetize it means to give it a chance to actually grow, to fund itself, to give people a livelihood, to do good. So that is an amazing trait that you're right that we have here in Israel. One problem, though, is ironically with all of this great stuff that we're making that is better for humanity. The state of Israel's PR as a big company, as a Jewish people, as a country of the Jewish people, is not doing so well. There's a lot of contra PR at the same time. I thought maybe you could comment on that.
I have an answer to that. Please. I believe in a parallel universe. Okay, I can't. What's interesting also is on this trip. I have an Airbnb apartment that I rented. I don't have a TV. I have not watched television in almost 2 months. And I really, other than, on Twitter, Facebook, and, I'll look at the New York Times and things like that, to kind of get news what's going on. But I've really tried to tune out the news. And what's really interesting is I believe Israel really lives, we have a parallel universe. Yes, there are things that go on here that unfortunately there's bad stuff that can go on here that also goes on in other parts of the world. They're just not politicized in the other parts of the world. But here, the universe that I try to live in is all the wonderful good, all these really cool people, all these people taking risks with their businesses, doing really good things to try to make the world an ever so slightly better place.
We're speaking with Alan Weinkrantz. If you want to check out his website, it's alanweinkrantz.com. He's a tech PR and startup communication strategist. He is leading the way for people to know about the Startup Nation. By the way, I came up with a concept that you could share with people, right? You know that we're the Startup Nation. But we also have Shabbat, right? And Shabbat is the shutdown nation. We also know when to shut down, when to turn off the Wi-Fi. That's what I do for Shabbat. I turn off the Wi-Fi in my house and to kind of take a break, know how to kind of come back to nature, kind of get off that tree of technology, which is pushing us forward. In one sense, kind of come back to the simple humanity, back to family, back to spirituality. That's also part of Israel, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I also believe, actually, I was talking to my daughter last night on Skype, and she was saying, man, you sure are eating well. I go, how do you know? She says, I see your photos on Instagram. And I will tell you that when I'm drinking, I only buy Israeli wine, of course, when I'm here, and I think I'm drinking God's DNA. I mean, there's something in the, because I know that.
Alan, I'm going to have to steal that one from you. I'll give you credit, though. Okay. I'll always give you credit, but God's DNA, that's yours. That's a Weinkrantz special.
Okay. And the produce I know came from a kibbutz or a moshav, 10 miles away. The produce, the fruit, the cheese. And in fact, actually, both my kids, when they came, both my kids, have been here and they've gone to school here. I noticed that. When they came back, they would only buy Israeli goat cheese at home. Now, do you know how expensive Israeli goat cheese is at Whole Foods? But this is what my kids wanted to do.
That's the land of milk and honey.
That's the land of milk and honey and algorithms. Okay. Now, there's one other.
Go ahead.
Just one other thing. Again, just kind of what I believe. There's this theory that the universe keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. So it would stand to reason that as the universe expands and expands, so do the opportunities for Israel. Because if we are the core of the universe, we are indeed the chosen people, that I think it's divine, and I think it's God's divine intervention that we are doing what we're doing. And as the universe expands, so do the opportunities for Israel to make the world a better place.
But those opportunities are not without challenges, and being the chosen people is a job description and not a gift. There's a lot of effort that goes into that. There's a lot of sweat and toil and a lot of sacrifice and human sacrifice, and there are dark energies out there.
Absolutely.
Then those dark energies are like a cataract. They want to bring down the light, and we're recording this on the 8th day of Hanukkah. It's a pleasure for me to have you in studio on the 8th day of Hanukkah, which in my mind symbolizes the ultimate light, the ultimate success of Israel to be a light unto the nations. It's like the fulfillment. It's like not seven candles, it's like eight. It's all the way, and it's at its brightest and its lightest. And you give me hope that there's this parallel universe. Some people only want to see one side of it, but they don't see the amazing light that's coming out of Israel. Go ahead.
One more thing. For people listening outside, you know, people ask me, is it safe to be here? And I always explain, you know, there is one danger about being in Israel. I always tend to gain 3 to 5 pounds. So, and the sufganiyot, fabulous.
That's indeed a danger here. We got to watch our calories as well. Probably we'll create an app to make us even healthier with that. Folks, you're listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. Alan Weinkratz has been my guest, tech PR and startup communications strategist. Pinchas Orbach across the glass. Thank you so much for joining me. More great stuff is on the way, and shalom.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. We had a great show today, right? We had a lot of life and death with Rabbi Mike Foyer, who taught us about the land of the living, the land of Israel, but also those who rejected it, who chose death. We heard from a man who had life and death. We heard from the funeral, the procession of burying Irving Moskowitz on the Mount of Olives. We heard the amazing work that he did in his life and the impact that he had. And the same for Alan Weinkratz, who was killed in a tragic car accident. A car killing him when he was at a restaurant in a tragic circumstance in Tel Aviv just last week. We got to hear from him as well. And so together, what we see is that there's a great circle of life. It's the greatest gift that we have. We have to take every single moment of our life and use it in its maximal capacity, really doing God's work, being rich about life, biting into the apple of life, taking it maximally, and really not wasting a moment in this precious, precious gift. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. I want to hear from you, so connect to me by either writing me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, or connecting with me on Twitter @YishaiFleischer, Facebook, Yishai Fleischer, LinkedIn, YouTube. I'm out there to connect with you so that we could all be connected to God's amazing story. So stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. God bless you wherever you are, and shalom.